It was quickened by his enemies, in the interests of the unreformed religion, putting in the King of TMS way, at a state dinner, a niece of the Duke of Norfolk, Catherine Howard, a young lady of fascinating manners, though small in stature and not particularly beautiful. Falling in love with her on the spot, the king soon divorced Anne of Cleves after making her the subject of much brutal talk, on pretense that she had been previously betrothed to someone else, which would never do for one of his dignity, and married Catherine. It is probable that on his wedding day, of all days in the year, he sent his faithful Cromwell to the scaffold, and had his head struck off. He further celebrated the occasion by burning at one time, and causing to be drawn to the fire on the same hurdles, some Protestant prisoners for denying the Pope TMS doctrines, and some Roman Catholic prisoners for denying his own supremacy. Still the people bore it, and not a gentleman in England raised his hand. But, by a just retribution, it soon came out that Catherine Howard, before her marriage, had been really guilty of such crimes as the king had falsely attributed to his second wife Anne Boleyn. So, again the dreadful axe made the king a widower, and this queen passed away as so many in that reign had passed away before her. As an appropriate pursuit under the circumstances, Henry then applied himself to superintending the composition of a religious book called A Necessary Doctrine for Any Christian Man. ATM he must have been a little confused in his mind, I think, at about this period, for he was so false to himself as to be true to someone, that someone being Cranmer, whom the Duke of Norfolk and others of his enemies tried to ruin, but to whom the king was steadfast, and to whom he one night gave his ring, charging him when he should find himself, next day, accused of treason, to show it to the council board. This Cranmer did to the confusion of his enemies. I suppose the king thought he might want him a little longer. He married yet once more. Yes, strange to say, he found in England another woman who would become his wife, and she was Catherine Parr, widow of Lord Latimer. She leaned towards the reformed religion, and it is some comfort to know that she tormented the king considerably by arguing a variety of doctrinal points with him on all possible occasions. She had very nearly done this to her own destruction. After one of these conversations, the king, in a very black mood, actually instructed Gardiner, one of his bishops who favoured the popish opinions, to draw a bill of accusation against her, which would have inevitably brought her to the scaffold where her predecessors had died, but that one of her friends picked up the paper of instructions which had been dropped in the palace, and gave her timely notice. She fell ill with terror, but managed the king so well when he came to entrap her into further statements by saying that she had only spoken on such points to divert his mind and to get some information from his extraordinary wisdom, that he gave her a kiss and called her his sweetheart. And, when the Chancellor came next day actually to take her to the Tower, the king sent him about his business, and honoured him with the epithets of a beast, a knave, and a fool. So near was Catherine Parr to the block, and so narrow was her escape. There was war with Scotland in this reign, and a short clumsy war with France for favouring Scotland, but the events at home were so dreadful, and leave such an enduring stain on the country, that I need say no more of what happened abroad. A few more horrors, and this reign is over. There was a lady, Anne Askew, in Lincolnshire, who inclined to the Protestant opinions, and whose husband, being a fierce Catholic, turned her out of his house. She came to London, and was considered as offending against the six articles, and was taken to the Tower, and put upon the rack, probably because it was hoped that she might, in her agony, criminate some obnoxious persons, if falsely, so much the better. She was tortured without uttering a cry, until the lieutenant of the Tower would suffer his men to torture her no more, and then two priests who were present actually pulled off their robes, and turned the wheels of the rack with their own hands, so rending and twisting and breaking her that she was afterwards carried to the fire in a chair. She was burned with three others, a gentleman, a clergyman, and a tailor, and so the world went on. Either the king became afraid of the power of the Duke of Norfolk, and his son the Earl of Surrey, or they gave him some offence, but he resolved to pull them down, to follow all the rest who were gone. The son was tried first to, of course, for nothing, and defended himself bravely, but of course he was found guilty, and of course he was executed. Then his father was laid hold of, and left for death too. But the king himself was left for death by a greater king, and the earth was to be rid of him at last. He was now a swollen, hideous spectacle, with a great hole in his leg, and so odious to every sense that it was dreadful to approach him. When he was found to be dying, Cranmer was sent for from his palace at Croydon, and came with all speed, but found him speechless. Happily, in the tower he perished. He was in the 56th year of his age, and the 38th of his reign. Henry VIII has been favored by some Protestant writers, because the Reformation was achieved in his time. But the mighty merit of it lies with other men and not with him, and it can be rendered none the worse by this monster at TMS crimes, and none the better by any defense of them. The plain truth is, that he was a most intolerable ruffian, a disgrace to human nature, and a blot of blood and grease upon the history of England. Chapter XXXII England under Edward VI. Henry VIII had made a will, appointing a council of 16 to govern the kingdom for his son while he was under age. He was now only 10 years old, and another council of 12 to help them. The most powerful of the first council was the Earl of Hertford, the young king at TMS uncle, who lost no time in bringing his nephew with great state up to Enfield, and thence to the Tower. It was considered at the time a striking proof of virtue in the young king that he was sorry for his father at TMS death, but, as common subjects have that virtue too, sometimes, we will say no more about it. There was a curious part of the late king of TMS will, requiring his executors to fulfill whatever promises he had made. Some of the court wondering what these might be, the Earl of Hertford and the other noblemen interested, said that they were promises to advance and enrich them. So, the Earl of Hertford made himself Duke of Somerset, and made his brother Edward Seymour a baron, and there were various similar promotions, all very agreeable to the parties concerned, and very dutiful, no doubt, to the late King of TMS memory. To be more dutiful still, they made themselves rich out of the church lands, and were very comfortable. The new Duke of Somerset caused himself to be declared protector of the kingdom, and was, indeed, the king. As young Edward VI had been brought up in the principles of the Protestant religion, everybody knew that they would be maintained. But Cranmer, to whom they were chiefly entrusted, advanced them steadily and temperately. Many superstitious and ridiculous practices were stopped, but practices which were harmless were not interfered with. The Duke of Somerset, the Protector, was anxious to have the young king engaged in marriage to the young Queen of Scotland, in order to prevent that princess from making an alliance with any foreign power, but, as a large party in Scotland were unfavourable to this plan, he invaded that country. His excuse for doing so was, that the bordermen, that is, the Scotch who lived in that part of the country where England and Scotland joined, troubled the English very much. But there were two sides to this question, for the English bordermen troubled the Scotch too, and, through many long years, there were perpetual border quarrels which gave rise to numbers of old tales and songs. However, the Protector invaded Scotland, and Arran, the Scottish regent, with an army twice as large as his, advanced to meet him. They encountered on the banks of the River Esk, within a few miles of Edinburgh, and there, after a little skirmish, the Protector made such moderate proposals, in offering to retire if the Scotch would only engage not to marry their princess to any foreign prince, that the regent thought the English were afraid. But in this he made a horrible mistake, for the English soldiers on land, and the English sailors on the water, so set upon the Scotch, that they broke and fled, and more than 10,000 of them were killed. It was a dreadful battle, for the fugitives were slain without mercy. The ground for 4 miles, all the way to Edinburgh, was strewn with dead men, and with arms, and legs, and heads. Some hid themselves in streams and were drowned, some threw away their armour and were killed running, almost naked, but in this Battle of Pinkie the English lost only 200 or 300 men. They were much better clothed than the Scotch, at the poverty of whose appearance and country they were exceedingly astonished. a parliament was called when Somerset came back, and it repealed the whip with six strings, and did one or two other good things, though it unhappily retained the punishment of burning for those people who did not make believe to believe, in all religious matters, what the government had declared that they must and should believe. It also made a foolish law, meant to put down beggars, that any man who lived idly and loitered about for 3 days together, should be burned with a hot iron, made a slave, and wear an iron fetter. But this savage absurdity soon came to an end, and went the way of a great many other foolish laws. The Protector was now so proud that he sat in Parliament before all the nobles, on the right hand of the throne. Many other noblemen, who only wanted to be as proud if they could get a chance, became his enemies of course, and it is supposed that he came back suddenly from Scotland because he had received news that his brother, Lord Seymour, was becoming dangerous to him. This lord was now High Admiral of England, a very handsome man, and a great favourite with the court ladies, or even with the young Princess Elizabeth, who romped with him a little more than young princesses in these times do with anyone. He had married Catherine Parr, the late King Otm's widow, who was now dead, and, to strengthen his power, he secretly supplied the young king with money. He may even have engaged with some of his brother Otm's enemies in a plot to carry the boy off. On these and other accusations, at any rate, he was confined in the Tower, impeached, and found guilty, his own brother Otm's name being a unnatural and sad to tell of the first signs to their warrant of his execution. He was executed on Tower Hill, and died denying his treason. One of his last proceedings in this world was to write two letters, one to the Princess Elizabeth, and one to the Princess Mary, which a servant of his took charge of, and concealed in his shoe. These letters are supposed to have urged them against his brother, and to revenge his death. What they truly contained is not known, but there is no doubt that he had, at one time, obtained great influence over the Princess Elizabeth. All this while, the Protestant religion was making progress. The images which the people had gradually come to worship, were removed from the churches, the people were informed that they need not confess themselves to priests unless they chose, a common prayer book was drawn up in the English language, which all could understand, and many other improvements were made, still moderately. For Cranmer was a very moderate man, and even restrained the Protestant clergy from violently abusing the unreformed religion as they very often did, and which was not a good example. But the people were at this time in great distress. The rapacious nobility who had come into possession of the church lands, were very bad landlords. They enclosed great quantities of ground for the feeding of sheep, which was then more profitable than the growing of crops, and this increased the general distress. So the people, who still understood little of what was going on about them, and still readily believed what the homeless monks told them, many of whom had been their good friends in their better days, took it into their heads that all this was owing to the reformed religion, and therefore rose, in many parts of the country. The most powerful risings were in Devonshire and Norfolk. In Devonshire, the rebellion was so strong that 10,000 men united within a few days, and even laid siege to Exeter. But Lord Russell, coming to the assistance of the citizens who defended that town, defeated the rebels, and, not only hanged the mayor of one place, but hanged the vicar of another from his own church steeple. What with hanging and killing by the sword, 4,000 of the rebels are supposed to have fallen in that one county. In Norfolk, where the rising was more against the enclosure of open lands than against the reformed religion, the popular leader was a man named Robert Kitt, a tanner of Wymondham. The mob were, in the first instance, excited against the tanner by one John Flowerdew, a gentleman who owed him a grudge, but the tanner was more than a match for the gentleman, since he soon got the people on his side, and established himself near Norwich with quite an army. There was a large oak tree in that place, on a spot called Mousehold Hill, which Kitt named the Tree of Reformation, and under its green boughs, he and his men sat, in the midsummer weather, holding courts of justice, and debating affairs of state. They were even impartial enough to allow some rather tiresome public speakers to get up into this Tree of Reformation, and point out their errors to them, in long discourses, while they lay listening, not always without some grumbling and growling, in the shade below. At last, one sunny July day, a herald appeared below the tree, and proclaimed Kut and all his men traitors, unless from that moment they dispersed and went home, in which case they were to receive a pardon. But Kut and his men made light of the herald and became stronger than ever, until the Earl of Warwick went after them with a sufficient force, and cut them all to pieces. A few were hanged, drawn, and quartered, as traitors, and their limbs were sent into various country places to be a terror to the people. Nine of them were hanged upon nine green branches of the Oak of Reformation, and so, for the time, that tree may be said to have withered away. The Protector, though a haughty man, had compassion for the real distresses of the common people, and a sincere desire to help them. But he was too proud and too high in degree to hold even their favor steadily, and many of the nobles always envied and hated him, because they were as proud and not as high as he. He was at this time building a great palace in the Strand, to get the stone for which he blew up church steeples with gunpowder, and pulled down bishops at E.M. houses, thus making himself still more disliked. At length, his principal enemy, the Earl of Warwick Dudley by name, and the son of that Dudley who had made himself so odious with Impson, in the reign of Henry VII, joined with seven other members of the council against him, formed a separate council, and, becoming stronger in a few days, sent him to the Tower under 29 articles of accusation. After being sentenced by the council to the forfeiture of all his offices and lands, he was liberated and pardoned, on making a very humble submission. He was even taken back into the council again, after having suffered this fall, and married his daughter, Lady Anne Seymour, to Warwick T.M.'s eldest son. But such a reconciliation was little likely to last, and did not outlive a year. Warwick, having got himself made Duke of Northumberland, and having advanced the more important of his friends, then finished the history by causing the Duke of Somerset and his friend Lord Grey, and others, to be arrested for treason, in having conspired to seize and dethrone the king. They were also accused of having intended to seize the new Duke of Northumberland, with his friends Lord Northampton and Lord Pembroke, to murder them if they found need, and to raise the city to revolt. All this the fallen Protector positively denied, except that he confessed to having spoken of the murder of those three noblemen, but having never designed it. He was acquitted of the charge of treason, and found guilty of the other charges. So when the people who remembered his having been their friend, now that he was disgraced and in danger, saw him come out from his trial with the axe turned from him, they thought he was altogether acquitted, and sent up a loud shout of joy. But the Duke of Somerset was ordered to be beheaded on Tower Hill, at 8 o'clock in the morning, and proclamations were issued bidding the citizens keep at home until after 10. They filled the streets, however, and crowded the place of execution as soon as it was light, and, with sad faces and sad hearts, saw the once powerful Protector ascend the scaffold to lay his head upon the dreadful block. While he was yet saying his last words to them with manly courage, and telling them, in particular, how it comforted him, at that pass, to have assisted in reforming the national religion, a member of the council was seen riding up on horseback. They again thought that the Duke was saved by his bringing a reprieve, and again shouted for joy. But the Duke himself told them they were mistaken, and laid down his head and had it struck off at a blow. Many of the bystanders rushed forward and steeped their handkerchiefs in his blood, as a mark of their affection. He had, indeed, been capable of many good acts, and one of them was discovered after he was no more. The Bishop of Durham, a very good man, had been informed against to the council, when the Duke was in power, as having answered a treacherous letter proposing a rebellion against the reformed religion. As the answer could not be found, he could not be declared guilty, but it was now discovered, hidden by the Duke himself among some private papers, in his regard for that good man. The bishop lost his office, and was deprived of his possessions. It is not very pleasant to know that while his uncle lay in prison under sentence of death, the young king was being vastly entertained by plays, and dances, and sham fights. But there is no doubt of it, for he kept a journal himself. It is pleasant to know that not a single Roman Catholic was burnt in this reign for holding that religion, though two wretched victims suffered for heresy. One, a woman named Joan Botcher, for professing some opinions that even she could only explain in unintelligible jargon. The other, a Dutchman, named Von Paris, who practiced as a surgeon in London. Edward was, to his credit, exceedingly unwilling to sign the warrant for the woman at EMS execution, shedding tears before he did so, and telling Cranmer, who urged him to do it, though Cranmer really would have spared the woman at first, but for her own determined obstinacy, that the guilt was not his, but that of the man who so strongly urged the dreadful act. We shall see, too soon, whether the time ever came when Cranmer is likely to have remembered this with sorrow and remorse. Cranmer and Ridley, at first Bishop of Rochester, and afterwards Bishop of London, were the most powerful of the clergy of this reign. Others were imprisoned and deprived of their property for still adhering to the unreformed religion, the most important among whom were Gardiner Bishop of Winchester, Heath Bishop of Worcester, Day Bishop of Chichester, and Bonner that Bishop of London who was superseded by Ridley. The Princess Mary, who inherited her mother at EMS gloomy temper, and hated the reformed religion as connected with her mother at EMS wrongs and sorrows as she knew nothing else about it, always refusing to read a single book in which it was truly described or held by the unreformed religion too, and was the only person in the kingdom for whom the old mass was allowed to be performed, nor would the young king have made that exception even in her favour, but for the strong persuasions of Cranmer and Ridley. He always viewed it with horror, and when he fell into a sickly condition, after having been very ill, first of the measles and then of the smallpox, he was greatly troubled in mind to think that if he died, and she, the next heir to the throne, succeeded, the Roman Catholic religion would be set up again. This uneasiness, the Duke of Northumberland was not slow to encourage, for, if the Princess Mary came to the throne, he, who had taken part with the Protestants, was sure to be disgraced. Now, the Duchess of Suffolk was descended from King Henry VII, and, if she resigned what little or no right she had, in favour of her daughter Lady Jane Grey, that would be the succession to promote the Duke at EMS greatness, because Lord Guildford Dudley, one of his sons, was, at this very time, newly married to her. So, he worked upon the King at EMS fears, and persuaded him to set aside both the Princess Mary and the Princess Elizabeth, and assert his right to appoint his successor. Accordingly the young king handed to the crown lawyers a writing signed half a dozen times over by himself, appointing Lady Jane Grey to succeed to the crown, and requiring them to have his will made out according to law. They were much against it at first, and told the king so. But the Duke of Northumberland being so violent about it that the lawyers even expected him to beat them, and hotly declaring that, stripped to his shirt, he would fight any man in such a quarrel, they yielded. Cranmer, also, at first hesitated, pleading that he had sworn to maintain the succession of the crown to the Princess Mary, but, he was a weak man in his resolutions, and afterwards signed the document with the rest of the council. It was completed none too soon, for Edward was now sinking in a rapid decline, and, by way of making him better, they handed him over to a woman doctor who pretended to be able to cure it. He speedily got worse. On the 6th of July, in the year 1553, he died, very peaceably and piously, praying God, with his last breath, to protect the reformed religion. This king died in the 16th year of his age, and in the 7th of his reign. It is difficult to judge what the character of one so young might afterwards have become among so many bad, ambitious, quarrelling nobles, but, he was an amiable boy, of very good abilities, and had nothing coarse or cruel or brutal in his disposition, which in the son of such a father is rather surprising. Chapter XXXII England under Mary. The Duke of Northumberland was very anxious to keep the young king at EMS death a secret, in order that he might get the two princesses into his power. But, the Princess Mary, being informed of that event as she was on her way to London to see her sick brother, turned her horsey EMS head, and rode away into Norfolk. The Earl of Arundel was her friend, and it was he who sent her warning of what had happened. As the secret could not be kept, the Duke of Northumberland and the council sent for the Lord Mayor of London and some of the aldermen, and made a merit of telling it to them. Then, they made it known to the people, and set off to inform Lady Jane Grey that she was to be queen. She was a pretty girl of only 16, and was amiable, learned, and clever. When the lords who came to her, fell on their knees before her, and told her what tidings they brought, she was so astonished that she fainted. On recovering, she expressed her sorrow for the young king at Hiamet's death, and said that she knew she was unfit to govern the kingdom, but that if she must be queen, she prayed God to direct her. She was then at Sion House, near Brentford, and the lords took her down the river in state to the tower, that she might remain there, as the custom was, until she was crowned. But the people were not at all favourable to Lady Jane, considering that the right to be queen was Mary at Hiamet, and greatly disliking the Duke of Northumberland. They were not put into a better humour by the Duke at Hiamet causing a vintner at Hiamet servant, one Gabriel Pott, to be taken up for expressing his dissatisfaction among the crowd, and to have his ears nailed to the pillory, and cut off. Some powerful men among the nobility declared on Mary at Hiamet's side. They raised troops to support her cause, had her proclaimed queen at Norwich, and gathered around her at the castle of Framlingham, which belonged to the Duke of Norfolk. For, she was not considered so safe as yet, but that it was best to keep her in a castle on the sea coast, from whence she might be sent abroad, if necessary. The council would have dispatched Lady Jane at Hiamet's father, the Duke of Suffolk, as the general of the army against this force, but, as Lady Jane implored that her father might remain with her, and as he was known to be but a weak man, they told the Duke of Northumberland that he must take the command himself. He was not very ready to do so, as he mistrusted the council much, but there was no help for it, and he set forth with a heavy heart, observing to a lord who rode beside him through Shoreditch at the head of the troops, that, although the people pressed in great numbers to look at them, they were terribly silent. And his fears for himself turned out to be well founded. While he was waiting at Cambridge for further help from the council took it into their heads to turn their backs on Lady Jane at Hiamet's cause, and to take up the Princess Mary at Hiamet. This was chiefly owing to the before-mentioned Earl of Arundel, who represented to the Lord Mayor and Alderman, in a second interview with those sagacious persons, that, as for himself, he did not perceive the reformed religion to be in much danger, which Lord Pembroke backed by flourishing his sword as another kind of persuasion. The Lord Mayor and Alderman, thus enlightened, said there could be no doubt that the Princess Mary ought to be queen. So, she was proclaimed at the cross by St. Paul at Hiamet, and barrels of wine were given to the people, and they got very drunk, and danced round blazing bonfires, a little thinking, poor wretches, what other bonfires would soon be blazing in Queen Mary at Hiamet's name. After a 10 days at Hiamet dream of royalty, Lady Jane Grey resigned the crown with great willingness, saying that she had only accepted it in obedience to her father and mother, and went gladly back to her pleasant house by the river, and her books. Mary then came on towards London, and at Wanstead in Essex, was joined by her half-sister, the Princess Elizabeth. They passed through the streets of London to the Tower, and there the new queen met some eminent prisoners then confined in it, kissed them, and gave them their liberty. Among these was that Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, who had been imprisoned in the last train for holding to the unreformed religion. Him she soon made Chancellor. The Duke of Northumberland had been taken prisoner, and, together with his son and 5 others, was quickly brought before the council. He, not unnaturally, asked that council, in his defence, whether it was treason to obey orders that had been issued under the Great Seal, and, if it were, whether they, who had obeyed them too, ought to be his judges. But they made light of these points, and, being resolved to have him out of the way, soon sentenced him to death. He had risen into power upon the death of another man, and made but a poor show, as might be expected, when he himself lay low. He entreated Gardiner to let him live, If it were only in a mouse it a mess hole, and, when he ascended the scaffold to be beheaded on Tower Hill, addressed the people in a miserable way, saying that he had been incited by others, and exhorting them to return to the unreformed religion, which he told them was his faith. There seems reason to suppose that he expected a pardon even then, in return for this confession, but it matters little whether he did or not.